This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Pat Mines, Iran airs the confessions of two French spies, admitting to their support for anti-government protests and regime change efforts in Iran. Negative economic data could be tipping the United States toward recession ahead of the pivotal midterm elections in which the control of Congress will be at stake. And police in Thailand say more than 30 people, most of them children, have been killed in a gun and knife attack. Hello and welcome, everybody. Iran has released a video of two French spies arrested some 4 months ago in which they've admitted to their efforts to incite chaos and unrest in the country. One of the spies has admitted to being an agent at the French Foreign Intelligence Agency, known as the General Directorate for External Security. She proceeds to explain how they brought in large sums of cash in order to fund riots and strikes, as well as purchase weaponry in an attempt to stir up chaos. She also states that their main aim was to lay the groundwork for mass unrest and trigger a revolution in Iran. The Iranian Ministry of Intelligence announced their arrest in late May. The ministry stated that they'd entered the country with the aim of hijacking peaceful rallies to create social disorder. The U.S. Negative economic data continues to pile up 5 weeks into the midterms. A record plunge in the number of job openings has many declaring that the country is officially in a recession. Rami Mazuri has more from Chicago.
New jobs data in the United States showed a collapse of 1.1 million job openings, the biggest one-month crash ever outside of the COVID lockdown. It's also the first increase in the unemployment rate since April 2020, and that has many so-called recession deniers being forced to reconsider. The United States has had two consecutive quarters of negative economic growth, which is the standard definition of economic recession. However, in an effort to avoid the negative press the recession label receives, the administration of President Joe Biden claimed that a stable unemployment rate meant that the U.S. was not in a recession. That's no longer possible. Due to the so-called Uberization of the United States economy, the official data has long been accused of falsely portraying a rosy picture. The national unemployment rate is 4%, but many say the jobs available are part-time or lack crucial benefits like health care, or are poorly paid despite the current record inflation.
People looking for benefits, they want to work from home. People are not settling like they used to. It's just a matter of, I don't want to say laziness, but I think people are just, they're trying to get the best that they want, and companies are trying to hold steady and their wages, and they're not willing to pay as much because costs are going up for them as well.
Amid the backfiring of Western sanctions on Russia, many businesses have responded by cutting job listings, slowing the hiring process, and may begin mass layoffs.
Now we've got the threat of recession, so some employers are cutting back on their hiring. My son-in-law just had to fire several people he had who were hiring people. So they're cutting back on their hiring process based on a precautionary measure, thinking there might be a recession.
The widespread perception is that America's central bank is forcing a recession to reduce inflation, even if that means throwing millions out of work, out of their homes, and guts pensions, which are usually based on the stock market. The drop in jobs is the latest piece of data which shows a dangerously worsening economic situation for the average American. Wages are losing ground to inflation at a record pace, and an economically chaotic October could translate into a painful holiday season for many. Ramin Mazahari, Chicago.
on this segment of the program. The Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries, OPEC, and its Russian-led allies have announced a big cut in oil production from the coming November, defying the U.S. pressure. During a meeting in Vienna, the 23 countries, together known as OPEC Plus, agreed to reduce the output by 2 million barrels per day to boost a crude market already reeling from the global economic crisis. That's over 2% of the global oil production and comes amid soaring energy prices. The move prompted a blistering reaction from the White House. In a statement, Washington expressed disappointment over what it called short-sighted decision by the cartel. It said the president would consult with the Congress to reduce OPEC's control over energy prices. The U.S. already warned the cartel against the crippling consequences of the measure for the world economy. Well, joining us on this edition of the News Review, we have economist and author Steve Keane, who's joining us from Bangkok. We also have Professor of Economics, Mr. Rodney Shakespeare, who's with us from the British capital, London. Gentlemen, welcome to the program. Let's start off with Mr. Keane in Bangkok. What impact can this 2 million barrel cut have on the oil price, as well as the fuel prices in Europe and the United States?
Well, we've got a time where obviously energy costs have risen dramatically already because of the cutoff of the gas to Europe from Russia, the sabotage. We still don't know who caused that. All this is teaching us the extent to which we are absolutely dependent upon energy. And at the same time, we're in a period where we're exhausting the supply of cheap oil, and the prices are going to rise. So it's a further squeeze and a further show of the power of the energy providers in the global economy right now, and the fragility of the global economy because of that. I expect this will continue putting pressure, upward pressure on prices, and its debilitating impact upon the industrial countries who rely upon cheap oil to maintain their productive systems.
Rodney Shakespeare, winter is coming, as the saying goes. Will the U.S. And Europe be able to compensate this shortage as it starts to get colder?
This cut is designed to keep the price up. And it's highly significant because, you see, Saudi Arabia has long been a client state of the USA, which means that the USA supports a corrupt autocratic regime, and together stop democracy in West Asia. But Saudi Arabia is now starting to turn away from the United States. This is part of this great move from a unipolar world to a multipolar world. And Saudi Arabia's move to defy the USA is significant. Of course, the USA could lift sanctions on Iran. But American policy now is a mass of contradictions. They are all over the place. And basically, Saudi Arabia, by this move, is relatively small because it's only to quotas rather than actual production. This move is highly significant because it actually represents a humiliation for the USA and a sharp reminder that the world is changing in a very fundamental way.
All right, thanks a lot, gentlemen. Economist and author Steve Keane, joining us from Bangkok, and Professor of Economics Rodney Shakespeare, joining us from the British capital, London. With that, it brings us to an end here on this edition of the News Review. Moving on, tragedy in Thailand. An assailant has killed at least 35 people and injured others in an attack on a children's daycare center. The shooting happened in the province of Nong Bua Lumpur. The former police officer was agitated after not being able to find his kid at the nursery. He then attacked the people at the place with a gun and a knife, taking the lives of at least 22 children aged under 3 years. Later, he drove home and killed his wife and child before turning his weapon on himself. He had just attended a court hearing on a drug charge prior to the incident. Thailand's prime minister has called the tragedy horrifying and ordered a thorough investigation. Well, South Korea and Japan say the North has fired two short-range ballistic missiles amid escalating tensions on the Korean Peninsula. According to the South Korean military, the missiles were fired from Pyongyang towards the country's east coast and in the direction of Japan. This says North Korea's sixth missile launch in 12 days and the first since it fired an intermediate-range missile over Japan. North Korea's foreign ministry on Thursday said recent missile launches were, quote, counteraction measures against joint military drills by the U.S. and South Korea. It added that the joint drills escalate military tensions on the Korean Peninsula. Pyongyang considers such moves as rehearsals for an invasion. It accuses the U.S. and its regional allies of threatening it with war games and military buildup. Well, here's our correspondent Jennifer Chang in Seoul shedding more light on the fresh missile launches by North Korea. Let's listen in.
And experts say North Korea will conduct many more weapons tests in the coming months in order to complete this current round of modernization. And after that, it is expected to want to deal with North Korea as a nuclear power that does not have to follow the dictates of the U.S.-led international UN. Now, the UN Security Council has been having problems being led by the U.S. No longer will Russia and China go along with the U.S.'s request that it sanction the North over ballistic missile tests. After this latest intermediate range ballistic missile, which is being seen as a huge provocation by the U.S., China and Russia both blamed the U.S. for that IRBM test over Japan and refused to vote in favor of more sanctions against the North. So right now, the North is really having no limit to its modernization of its nuclear weapons or missile programs.
Well, turning now to the latest developments in the Ukraine war, President Volodymyr Zelensky says his forces have retaken some areas in the southern Kherson region from Russian troops. According to Zelensky, three settlements near the city of Kherson have been liberated. The advances were made after the latest maps revealed by Moscow showed Russian troops had left many areas in Kherson and the northeastern Kharkiv region. Kiev launched a counteroffensive in the beginning of September and says it has so far taken back thousands of square kilometers of Russian-controlled territory. That includes the strategic town of Liman in the eastern Donetsk region, which was a logistics and transport hub for Moscow's operations. Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov has said the areas recaptured by Kiev will eventually return to Russia. Meanwhile, the UN General Assembly is preparing to hold a vote on Russia's recent annexation of four Ukrainian regions. And after weeks of speculation over the assassination of Russian journalist Daria Dugina, here's what appears to be confirmation from American intelligence services about who did it. According to the New York Times, American officials believe the Ukrainian government, in fact, gave the green light to the car bomb attack near Moscow that killed Dugina in August. The paper has quoted unnamed officials as saying that the United States had no role in the assassination, but that it did scold Ukraine over the attack. Since the beginning of the war in Ukraine, Washington and Kiev have been sharing intelligence. The U.S. had also imposed sanctions on Dugina. Just a day after her murder, Russia laid the blame on Ukrainian intelligence services, but Kiev has denied involvement in the killing. It's widely believed that her father, Alexander Dugin, was the primary target. He's a prominent Russian nationalist and a supporter of the war in Ukraine. And soaring energy prices in Italy continue to bite. The Italian Retailers Association has announced that hundreds of thousands of firms are at the risk of closure next year as recession looms and the country's economic horizon.
On Wednesday, Italy's largest retailers association, Confcommercio, warned that over 120,000 small businesses risk shutting down in the first half of 2023. The association said firms are squeezed by the cost of living and skyrocketing energy prices. The president of Confcommercio, Carlo Sangalli, urged the government to do more to shield small and medium entrepreneurs, as the situation for many is now very critical.
There is the risk of a high number of business closures in the coming 9 months. Some small firms will simply find it more convenient to suspend their activity rather than losing 200 to 300 euros a day. Having said that, Italy will soon face a mild recession, which frankly is not as worrying as the media depict it.
Last month, Italy's outgoing government approved an aid package worth some 14 billion euros in an attempt to shield firms and families from surging energy costs. The measure came on top of over 50 billion euros already budgeted since January to soften the energy crisis in the country. However, the aid seems to be insufficient as an increasing number of businesses are struggling to stay afloat.
Everything costs at least 20% more. Energy prices keep soaring and it is very hard to keep going. We need help. The government must do something.
I cannot afford paying expenses for my family. I have four dependent children. They're all unemployed. Bills keep going up. How do we cope?
According to Confcommercio, more than 370,000 jobs are at risk as a result of the energy crisis. Meanwhile, energy giant Eni announced that gas supplies to Italy from Russia have resumed after 4 days. Russia's state-controlled Gazprom cut off gas supplies to Italy on Saturday, citing a problem linked to regulatory changes in Austria. Italy's national energy regulator, ARERA, warned last week that prices would climb by almost 60% by the end of the year, but experts argued that its estimate was optimistic. Bills have risen by 93% in Italy over the past 2 years, and the conflict between Russia and Ukraine, together with the damage recently sustained by Nord Stream pipelines, is likely to push costs even higher. Max Civili, Rome.
That's a wrap for now. Bye, everybody.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
forbidden files. But Cece never saw her husband's face again because her plane crashed that morning at 10:03. What took place on 9/11 was the deadliest attack on U.S. soil ever, which took the lives of almost 3,000 people. People whom some of their heartbreaking stories have been told and retold over and over again by mainstream media. But the greatest toll this incident took was neither on September the 11th nor in America. And that's where millions more heartbreaking stories are waiting to be heard. Hello and welcome to Hidden Files. I'm Marzieh Hashemi, and today I'm here to share with you stories of the fall of people who had nothing to do with the 9/11 attacks. People who fell victim to the campaign that started following September 11th. A campaign named the War on Terror. Following the September 11th attacks, U.S. President George W. Bush declared a global military war on terror campaign. He called on world leaders to join the U.S. in this fight and said, every nation in every region now has a decision to make. Either you are with us or with the terrorists. Bush then stated how this war on terror was to unfold. Our war on terror begins with Al-Qaeda, but it does not end there. It will not end until every terrorist group of global reach has been found, stopped, and defeated. Well, let's look at how a lot of these events unfolded. October the 7th, 2001, airstrikes were launched in Afghanistan by the U.S. and the U.K., followed by a ground offensive. Now, more than 240,000 Afghans were killed as a direct result. And then if we go forward to March the 19th, 2003, U.S. and coalition forces invaded Iraq, claiming that the country had weapons of mass destruction. More than 300,000 Iraqis were killed as a direct result. Today, the War on Terror campaign continues to be used as an excuse for bombing people from Afghanistan to Yemen. According to the Cost of War Project, by 2021, over 900,000 people had been killed in the War on Terror, and over 80 countries are currently being targeted by the War on Terror today. But was this War on Terror campaign a sudden decision in the aftermath of 9/11? Or were the attacks used as an excuse to justify a full-fledged pre-planned war? Well, our first guest, Scott Ritter, who is a whistleblower and former intelligence officer, is here with us to discuss more.
Scott Ritter, United States Marine Corps intelligence officer, who was a chief weapons inspector with the UN in Iraq from 1991 to 1998. Mr. Ritter quit the inspections team in 1998. He became a whistleblower and a critic of the Bush administration's claims that Iraq had weapons of mass destruction.
Thanks so much for being with us, Scott, here on Hidden Files. I mean, can you explain your perspective exactly what the concept of war on terror means?
We were attacked on 9/11. Now, we can have a discussion about whether or not this was blowback from, decades of American malpractice and malfeasance in the Middle East, that's a fair point. But we did not invite this attack. We did not want this attack. We did not will this attack. We were attacked. And, you know, the world saw that and recognized that. That's why the world rallied behind the United States in the aftermath of 9/11, saying this was unwarranted, this was unjust, this was horrible, and we will support the United States. But they weren't willing to support the United States in carrying out a counteroffensive that went beyond simply punishing those who perpetrated the attack. And that's what the war on terror became. It wasn't about punishing Al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden. It was about American asserting dominance on an entire region, and indeed, by doing so, on the entire world. And that's what the war on terror was. It wasn't a war on terror. It was basically a war of regional and global domination by the United States using a horrible act of terrorism as justification.
Well, do you feel that there was a plan to attack Iraq even prior to the September 11th attacks?
I think the Department of Defense had been heavily engaged with Iraq over the decade of the 90s, and that there were military contingencies in place that could have the United States defeating Iraq, occupying Iraq. These were plans. They weren't necessarily fully developed. The CIA would play a supporting role in that, but there is ample evidence that the United States had plans in the works for invading and occupying Iraq prior to 9/11.
Well, what are some of the lingering effects of the U.S. war on Iraq?
The war in Iraq has never ended. I mean, it continues to this day. The political instability that we see in Baghdad is a direct consequence of the decision by the United States to invade and occupy Iraq in 2003.
Well, do you think that the U.S. would have invaded Iraq even if the 9/11 attacks hadn't taken place, since Iraq really had nothing to do with those attacks anyway?
I think the events of 9/11 accelerated the inevitable military conflict between the United States and Iraq that had been brewing for over a decade since the end of Operation Desert Storm in 1991. The Clinton administration in 1998 had put in place a law that basically codified regime change as the official policy of the United States government. And the United States was moving toward a decisive confrontation with Iraq that would have occurred whether or not 9/11 took place. I think 9/11 accelerated this, but the American public was already pre-programmed to accept the notion that Saddam Hussein was an evil that needed to be confronted and destroyed. And they were unquestioning about the weapons of mass destruction narrative that was being put forward by the United States government well before 9/11.
Well, in your perspective, who benefited from the war?
I mean, the short-term benefit was getting rid of Saddam Hussein, who had proven to be a perpetual thorn in the side of multiple American presidential administrations. His continued survival was an embarrassment to the United States. But beyond that, the United States gained no benefit. This was a colossal failure. It was a failure from almost day one. We never won over the Iraqi people. We were always seen as an occupying force. And that notion of the American occupier flew in the face of what we were trying to promote, which is the role of the United States as a liberator, promulgating the model of American democracy as something that should be emulated regionally. Instead, we became the brutal occupier, and we turned the region and indeed much of the world against us. There's nothing positive that came out of America's precipitous invasion and occupation of Iraq.
Well, thank you so much for being with us right here on Hidden Files, Scott Ritter. Now, the war on terror was not limited to bombing locations claimed to be terrorist hotspots in different countries. It entailed control of countries and their resources. One example of such control was when Paul Bremer, an American diplomat, was deployed to Iraq, where he became the country's chief executive authority following the U.S.'s invasion. Now, he wanted to implement 100 different orders in Iraq through one of Bremer's orders. The Iraqi army was dismantled, also using Coalition Provisional Authority, CPA. Bremer changed the Iraqi constitution to benefit American authorities. For instance, CPA's draft included banning political parties opposed to the U.S.'s occupation from participating in elections, and so from the U.S. controlling any government that would come to be in Iraq, to the country even losing autonomy over its seed bank for farming, every aspect of life in Iraq was affected. Neoliberalism was being infused throughout the country, and it wasn't the Iraqi people who were profiting. There was a major heist during the occupation on so many levels, from cultural artifacts being stolen to the national wealth of the country's oil, being completely controlled by the U.S., to the billions of dollars that Western contractors won. Now, let's take a look at some of these contractors.
The number of contractors on the ground outnumbered U.S. troops most years of the U.S. occupation. American politicians were invested in the contractors. Many of them owned stocks in these contractors' companies. U.S. politicians had personal interests and stocks in these contractors. 51 congressmen and women, along with their spouses, owned between $2.3 and $5.8 million worth of stocks in the top 30 defense contractor companies. The Big Five, Lockheed Martin, Boeing, General Dynamics, Raytheon and Northrop Grumman, and some others acquired the next tier of manufacturers such as Hughes Aircraft and McDonnell Douglas. In the year to June 2020, the Big Five accounted for nearly a third of the $480 billion obligated by the Pentagon to defense contractors. Meanwhile, the defense sector spent over $2.4 billion lobbying Congress since 2001. These defense contractors make direct campaign contributions to most congressional members. 1. Lockheed Martin, total sales $46.5 billion. Gross profit $2.7 billion. 2. Boeing, total sales $68.7 billion. Gross profit $4 billion. 3. BAE, total sales $30.7 billion. Gross profit $2.3 billion. 4. General Dynamics, total sales $32.7 billion, gross profit $2.5 billion. 5. Northrop Grumman, total sales $26.4 billion, gross profit $2.1 billion.
I'd like to welcome my next guest to the program, Dr. Ranjit Brar.
Ranjit Brar. Dr. Brar is a political analyst, a journalist, and a public speaker. He has been actively involved in the British anti-war movement for 30 years. Brar regularly contributes to the workers' journals Proletarian and Laocoon. He is the author of Britain's Road to Socialism.
Well, thanks so much for joining me. Do you feel that there was a plan to attack Iraq prior to the September 11th attacks?
Well, I think the clearest indication that there was a pre-existing plan to attack Iraq prior to September 11th, 2001 was, of course, the fact that the original invasion of Iraq had taken place in 1990-1991 under George H. Bush. At that time, whilst Saddam Hussein was much weakened and Iraq was much weakened, and the oil for food program of quite draconian sanctions was installed upon Iraq, and famously Madeleine Albright, of course, at that time said it was worth the pain inflicted on the Iraqi people, in particular the 500,000 children who died of malnutrition and related diseases due to those sanctions. Madeleine Albright quite clearly said, yes, it was worth it. So there was obviously a pre-existing plan to invade Iraq. In terms of the 2003 invasion, there had been a plan. General Wesley Clark gave an interview in which he quite clearly said that around the 2001 attacks, when he was visiting Rumsfeld and Wolfowitz in the Pentagon, they'd clearly intimated him a plan not only to attack Iraq, but in fact the list of seven other countries in the immediate future.
Well, do you think the attacks were needed to use as justification for invading these countries?
In terms of whether 9/11, September 11, the attacks on the Twin Towers, Pentagon and White House, because let's not forget it was all three sites that were initially attacked, were a useful justification. They were certainly used as a useful justification. Were they necessary to justify those acts of aggression by the United States? Personally, whilst they were clearly, you know, they pitched their media to a level of hysteria and hyperbole not seen before or since, and pivoted towards the war on terror as justification for all of their aggressive operations abroad. In fact, that was nothing new in a sense, and really the Monroe Doctrine since 1847 had declared, you know, U.S. Right to dominate the Western Hemisphere, the Americas, as their own territorial sphere of interest, as their own colony, their de facto colony, their zone to exploit. Was in the aftermath of the collapse of the Soviet Union, really, that the United States and Bush, after Reagan, had really said there would be a new world order. This was the era in which America would be a world policeman, in which they would really come to now dominate the globe. And that unipolar moment, as we can call it, is a historical moment, has been continuing to this day. So was September 11th used by the United States establishment? Absolutely. Did they need that to justify their aggressive and hostile actions? Well, if you look at the American history, there have been perhaps 4 or 5 years in the total history of America when they've not been at war with one or another country. It's a country founded on genocide, essentially, and an empire founded upon ongoing bloodshed. There's not really been a single day's peace since the Second World War. America has been continual at war with other nations around the globe. So my personal feeling is that while they used it to their own advantage, they spun the media into a state of frenzy. They would have done exactly the same had September the 11th not occurred.
Who benefited from the war on Iraq?
That's a very good question. So the precise figures of the profits made by the U.S. state, and in particular U.S. companies, are hard to calculate. They will certainly run into hundreds of billions and trillions of dollars, and that would be the direct looting of Iraq's oil, which was the fundamental reason for going into Saddam Hussein, of course, was threatening to flout U.S. diktat, no longer comply with producing the necessary quantities of oil at the necessary prices in the interests of the U.S., and rather was going to cooperate with OPEC. So they lost control of Saddam Hussein, and this very important Iraq has perhaps 10 to 15% of the world's proven oil reserves, as has other important countries, of course, including Iran and Kuwait, Saudi in the region. What were the other things they benefited from? So the war itself, the incredible military expenditure. U.S. has a military budget of $850 billion per annum on military, more than enough to solve the vast majority of the world's problems in healthcare, in nutrition, and in housing. But of course, that money is not dedicated to solving those problems, but to reinforcing America's exploitation of the world and their exploitative position. But Lockheed Martin, Boeing, so many US defense contractors and companies made literally a killing, but absolute fortune in monetary terms from the war itself and from the sales of weapons to the American government, to the British government, to the coalition of the willing, so-called, and to other nations based on their testing of weapons on an army which, relatively speaking, was absolutely unable to defend itself against this huge onslaught of the world's largest industrial powers under the NATO umbrella. In addition to that, of course, there were huge contracts for reconstruction and occupation of Iraq over an extended period of time. And given the size of the bases and contractors who still operate in Iraq, you can see that those profits and loot are ongoing. And of course, ultimately, all of the money to pay for all of those operations came, in addition to an extent from the American taxpayer, overwhelmingly from loot extracted from the Iraq. And that includes, incidentally, the confiscation of the gold bullion reserves of the central bank. So however you look at it, this was an absolute, not even a neo-colonial, but a classical colonial operation of plunder, which meant that Iraq went from being one of the most prosperous countries on earth, more prosperous than most southern European nations, more prosperous than Spain, arguably more prosperous than Italy, certainly more prosperous than Greece, to being one of the poorest countries on earth, where chaos still rules. And this is precisely, of course, the intended desire, because while that chaos rules, while the Iraqi people can't demand the repatriation of their oil wealth, that looting continues.
Can you explain the concept of war on terror and how it served those who instigated this concept?
The concept of the war on terror was a very useful device to find a new enemy to justify the reason for not only ongoing military expenditure, ongoing NATO alliance, but in fact, it's constant expansion. As we've seen, NATO has been expanding right up towards the borders of Russia and China. So global domination, in fact, was the name of the game, but that was portrayed, you know, as America was a victim, America was the great upholder of democracy, America would be the world's policeman. It was America's mission to go and impose, you know, democracy, the free market, and institutions of NATO, EU, and other military alliances, essentially that served their own military and economic machine. So this essentially was making the world safe for the penetration of American capital. But, you know, war after war after war was fought against people after people to stop them having independent governments that would put the interests of those nations first.
Well, thank you so much for being with us right here in Hidden Files. September 11th was indeed a tragic event, but thanks to mainstream media, what many don't realize is that the main victims of the 9/11 incident were not Americans. They were unarmed civilians. They were Iraqi families, unsuspecting of who may break into their homes. Other victims of 9/11 were women and children being terrorized in their homes, and many are still being born with signs of terror all over their bodies, with horrifying birth defects due to depleted uranium and other chemicals. Birth defects like they were killed, wounded, and uprooted, not in the thousands, but in the millions. And yet they were neither paid reparations, nor did they even receive an official apology. And more importantly, there has been no accountability for the crimes committed, as trillions of dollars have been spent to cause havoc and to line the pockets of those heavily invested in war and chaos. Well, Hidden Files will continue to bring your attention to what's going on with this war on terror that was declared 21 years ago and is still causing death and destruction around the globe. Now, that's it for me, Marzia Hashemi, and all the crew here this week on Hidden Files.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are and wherever you are listening to us.
The keys of life.
The world is a very, very big house. Many people living in many rooms. We must open all the doors up. We must unlock them all today. Throw all the keys away.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Brothers and sisters, dear listeners, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and welcome to IRIB English Radio, and you are listening to the program Keys of Life, Mafatihul Hayat. I am your host, Abdullah Al-Musawi. we are looking at key number three, work and perseverance. When it comes to work, the Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam, they say you gotta be very careful that sometimes you get lazy and sometimes your self-esteem, your willpower, your energy starts to lack. When laziness happens, then your work would not be efficient, it would not be good, and everything will fall apart. So from here we see that Amir al-Mu'mineen salamullah alayhi says, إِنْ يَكُنِ الشُّغْلُ مَجْهَدَةً فَاتِّصَالُ الْفُرَاغِ مَفْسَدَةً. If it comes to work, and if it is, you know, exhaustion and you know, overworking, then obviously laziness is nothing but a corruption. When a person is not working, obviously he has nothing else to do. And Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam, he says, Al-kasalu yadhurru bid-dini wad-dunya. Surely laziness affects and corrupts not only this world, but also it affects the religion of a person. And then the Ahl-Bayt alayhi salam, they continue and they say a hadith from Imam Musa al-Kadhim alayhi salam. He says, إِنَّ اللَّهَ عَزَّ وَجَلْ يُبْغُضُ الْعَبْدُ النَّوَّامُ الْفَارَغُ. For Allah hates those who sleep, I mean oversleep, obviously, without a job, without a purpose. And we have so many people these days, especially with the youth. They spend their day, their nights playing games and wasting time, and they spend their days sleeping it off. And the same thing continues. So they have this boredom, they have this empty time, and they either entertaining themselves or either they are sleeping. Now, this is the life of an animal, because an animal has no intellect. So all it does, it tries to seek its own comfort. When I put my intellect to sleep and I switch off the key, then me and the animal, in fact, are the same. But actually, I become worse than the animal. Why? Because they have intellect. So Allah says in the Quran, "Kal an'ami bal adallu sabila." They are like animals, but worse off. So the Ahlul Bayt alayhim salam, they say Allah hates. Remember the word, hates, not loves, not likes, not, I don't know, recommends. Actually, He hates those who sleep too much and have nothing to do. Now, I look at myself. If I find myself spending too much time sleeping and too much time on my hand that I'm not doing anything constructive with, then I have to put a tick on myself and put myself in the corner of those whom Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala hates. And this is something not me and you wants to do. So Allah loves people who are working, loves people who are achieving, loves people who are progressing, loves people who are making a change and a difference in life. Because we always say, if you are not giving something extra back to life, then you are an extra on life. So we need to give back, not just to become consumers. And as we're doing today, we're sucking Mother Earth out of its resources to a dying point. Let us take a break, then we continue right after.
Ayatollah Javadi Amali, the author of the book Mafatihul Hayat, The Keys of Life. This book, Mafatih, ought to be in two volumes. One volume, the present volume, Mafatihul Janan, is on the level of the lofty rewards for praying, fasting, etc. But the book lacks its second volume, which ought to be on subjects like the lofty rewards for planting a tree. Imam has mentioned both of these subjects. The very Imam, who has stressed out the reward for praying, has also highlighted the reward for planting a tree. There are generous amounts of reward for protecting the environment. When growing wheat, take some in your hand and say these prayers. These are what the very Imam has mentioned. We lack this second volume in Islamic world.
Welcome back, brothers and sisters, and you are listening to the program The Keys of Life. Key number 3, work and perseverance. When it comes to work, the Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam, they highly recommend me and you to start early to work, early in the day, not in the middle of the day, not half of the day, not at night, but early in the morning. Why? Because there are so many benefits into me and you trying to do our work as early as we can. Don't take my word for it, of course. Take the word of the Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam. In his own words, the Prophet says, Al-Bukuru Mubarakun, waking up early, setting up early, is blessed. And we say, why, Ya Rasulullah? He says, Yuzidu fi jam'i ni'am. It increases your chances of getting more sustenance. The earlier you wake up, the earlier you start, the more chances you have of making more of whatever business or trade you are in, or whatever work you are doing. And then he says, خصوصاً في الرزق, especially in matters of sustenance, which indicates in this hadith that when it comes to sustenance, it is not only materialistic, not only wealth-wise, but spiritual as well. You wake up early, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala increases your wealth and he increases your spirituality. So if you want to be a spiritual person and a rich person at the same time, then you have to start and wake up early. Another hadith from the Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam himself, he says, if you have something to do, then do it early, for it should be easy. Now, we have this notion that we say, well, I'm not going to go too early because everyone goes early. So I'm going to stay, I don't know, 2 or 3 hours and then I'll go. I'll go like half, you know, during half of the hours of work time, you know, then it will be less people. I'll go just an hour or 2 hours before they close. You know, this way there will be less people. We constantly have this. Even if that's the case, even if there's less people, by the time you get to the worker or the teller or whoever you think that you need to do, you have to keep in mind he's tired. He's been there from the morning himself. And you've seen a lot of nasty people throughout the day. And when you get to him, his energy is out. Frustration is on the highest level. And you come to him and you want your things done. Especially if you don't have everything that is required to finish your application, for example. Then you could imagine what happens. While the Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam, he's saying to us, no, leave early. Do it earlier because it will be done a lot smoother and quicker. So you go to the teller, you have an application, you go to the counter, the guy's, you know, full of energy, he's happy the beginning of the day, and even if he sees things here and there that might need to be done, he might even overlook them and he might make the process a lot easier for you. Amir al-Mu'mineen salamullah alayhi, the commander of the faithful, he says in a hadith, should I tell you what will increase your rizq? Obviously, we want to know, Ya Amir al-Mu'mineen, who doesn't? He says, Al-Bukuru fi talab al-rizq. Then seek your sustenance at an earlier time. Thank you for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Driving past, walking fast, to the field of dreams. Hear the children scream.
There was The Keys of Life by Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran, IRIB English Radio.
Every corner represents
a different image in my mind. A momentary emotion, space spent in time, in time.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.